Erlen said. I swore by God and my Christian faith before I stole her virtue that I would never take any other wife, and she promised that she would never take any other husband for as long as we both should live. You said yourself, Gunnulf, that this was then a binding marriage before God. Whoever later wed another would be living in sin in his eyes. So it could not have been impure living that Kristin was my... It was not a sin that you lived with her, said the priest after a moment, if it could have been done without breaking other laws. But you drove her into sinful defiance against everyone God had put in charge of this child, and then you brought the shame of blood upon her. I told you this too, back when we talked of this matter. That's why the church has created laws regarding marriage, why bans must be announced, and why we priests must not marry man and maiden against the will of their kinsmen. He sat down, clasped his hands around one knee, and stared out across the summer bright landscape, where the little lake glinted blue at the bottom of the valley. Surely you must realize that, Erlan. You had sown a thicket of brambles around yourself, with nettles and thorns. How could you draw a young maiden to you without her being cut and flayed bloody? You stood by me more than once, brother. During that time when I was with Alina, said Erlan softly. I have never forgotten that. I don't think I would have done so, replied Gunnulf, and his voice quavered, if I had imagined that you would have the heart to behave in such a manner toward a pure and delicate maiden, and a mere child compared to you. Erlan said nothing. Gunnulf asked him gently, that time in Oslo, didn't you ever think about what would happen to Kristin if she became with child while she was living in the convent and was betrothed to another man? Her father, a proud and honorable man, and all her kinsmen of noble lineage, unaccustomed to bearing shame. Of course I thought about it. Erland had turned his face away. Munan promised to take care of her, and I told her that too. Munan? Would you deign to speak to a man like Munan of Kristin's honor? He's not the sort of man you think, said Erlan curtly. But what about our kinswoman, Fru Katrin? For surely you didn't intend for him to take Kristin to any of his other estates, where his paramours live. Erlan slammed his fist against the ground, making his knuckles bleed. The devil himself must have had a hand in it when a man's wife goes to his brother for confession. She hasn't confessed to me, said the priest, nor am I her parish priest. She told me her laments during her bitter fear and anguish, and I tried to help her and give her such advice and solace as I thought best. I see. Erlan threw back his head and looked up at his brother. I know that I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have allowed her to come to me at Brynhild's Inn. The priest sat speechless for a moment. At Brynhild Fluga's? Yes. Didn't she tell you that when she told you all the rest? It will be hard enough for Kristin to say such things about her lawful husband in confession, said the priest after a pause. I think she would rather die than speak of it anywhere else. He fell silent and then said harshly and vehemently, if you felt, Erlan, that you were her husband before God and the one who should protect and guard her, then I think your behavior was even worse. You seduced her in groves and in barns. You led her across a harlot's threshold, and finally up to Bjorn Gunnarsson and Fru Asild. You mustn't speak of Aunt Asild that way, said Erland in a low voice. You've said yourself that you thought our aunt caused the death of our father's brother, she and that man Bjorn. It makes no difference to me, said Erland forcefully. I'm fond of Aunt Asild. Yes, so I see, said the priest. A crooked, mocking little smile appeared on his lips. Since you were ready to leave her to face Lavrans Björgulfsson after you carried off his daughter, it seems as if you think that your affection is worth paying dearly for, Erland. Jesus! Erland hid his face in his hands. But the priest continued quickly. If only you had seen the torment of your wife's soul as she trembled in horror of her sins, unconfessed and unredeemed. as she sat there, about to give birth to your child, with death standing at the door. So young a child herself, and so unhappy. I know, I know. Erlan was shaking. I know she lay there thinking about this as she suffered. For Christ's sake, Gunnulf, say no more. I'm your brother after all. But he continued without mercy. If I had been a man like you and not a priest, and if I had led astray so young and good a maiden, I would have freed myself from that other woman. God help me, but I would have done as Aunt Osheel did to her husband and then burned in hell forever after, rather than allow my innocent and dearest beloved to suffer such things as you have done. Erlan sat in silence for a moment, trembling. You say that you're a priest, he said softly. Are you such a good priest that you have never sinned with a woman? Gunnulf did not look at his brother. Blood flushed red across his face. You have no right to ask me that. But I will answer you all the same. He who died for us on the cross knows how much I need his mercy. But I tell you, Erlan, if on the whole round disk of this earth he had not one servant who was pure and unmarked by sin, and if in his holy church there was not a single priest who was more faithful and worthy than I am, miserable betrayer of the Lord that I am, then the Lord's commandments and laws are what we can learn from this. His word cannot be defiled by the mouth of an impure priest. It can only burn and consume our own lips. Although perhaps you can't understand this. But you know as well as I, along with every filthy thrall of the devil that he has bought with his own blood, God's law cannot be shaken nor his honor diminished. Just as his sun is equally mighty, whether it shines above the barren sea and desolate gray moors, or above these fair lands. Erlan had hidden his face in his hands. He sat still for a long time, but when he spoke, his voice was dry and hard. Priest or no priest, since you're not such a strict adherent to pure living, don't you see? Could you have done that to a woman who had slept in your arms and borne you two children? Could you have done to her what our aunt did to her husband? The priest didn't answer at first. Then he said with some scorn, You don't seem to judge Aunt Osheel too harshly. But it can't be the same for a man as for a woman, said Erlan. I remember the last time they were here at Husaby, and Herr Bjorn was with them. We sat near the hearth, Mother and Aunt Osheel, and Herr Bjorn played the harp and sang for them. I stood at his knee. Then Uncle Bard called to her. He was in bed and he wanted her to come to bed too. He used words that were vulgar and shameless. Aunt Osheel stood up, and Herr Bjorn did too. He left the room, but before he did, they looked at each other. Later, when I was old enough to understand, I thought that it might be true after all. I had begged for permission to light the way for Herr Bjorn over to the loft where he was going to sleep, but I didn't dare. And I didn't dare sleep in the hall either. I ran outside and went to sleep with the men in the servants' house. By Jesus, Gunnulf, it can't be the same for a man as it was for Osheel that evening. No, Gunnulf, to kill a woman who, unless I caught her with another man, and yet that was exactly what he had done. But Gunnulf wouldn't dare mention that to his brother. Then the priest asked coldly, Wasn't it true that Elina had been unfaithful to you?
Unfaithful?
Erlan abruptly turned to face his brother, furious.
Do you think I should have blamed her for taking up with Gissur, after I had told her so often that it was over between us?
Gunnulf bowed his head. No. No doubt you're right, he said, his voice weary and low. But having won that small concession, Erlan flared up. He threw back his head and looked at the priest.
You take so much notice of Kristin, Gunnulf. The way you've been hanging about her all spring, almost more than is decent for a brother and a priest. It's as if you didn't want her to be mine. If things hadn't been the way they were with her when you first met, people might even think...
Gunnulf stared at him. Provoked by his brother's gaze, Erlan jumped to his feet.
Gunnulf stood up too. When he continued to stare, Erland lashed out at him with his fist. The priest grabbed his wrist. He tried to charge at Gunnulf, but his brother stood his ground. Erland grew meek at once. "I should have remembered that you're a priest," he said softly. "Well, you have nothing to repent on that account," said Gunnulf with a little smile. Erland stood there rubbing his wrist. "Yes. You always had such devilishly strong hands. This is the way it was when we were boys." Gunnulf's voice grew oddly tender and gentle. "I've thought about that often during the years I was away from home. About when we were boys. We often fought, but it never lasted long, Erland." "But now," said the other man sorrowfully, "it can never be the same as when we were boys, Gunnulf."
"No," murmured the priest. "I suppose it can't."
They stood in silence for a long time. Finally, Gunnulf said, "I'm going away now, Erland. I'll go down to bid Eilif farewell, and then I'm leaving. I'm heading over to visit the priest in Orkadal. I won't go to Nidaros while she is there." He gave a small smile.
"Gunnulf, I didn't mean... Don't leave me this way."
Gunnulf didn't move. He breathed hard several times and then he said, "There's one thing I want to tell you, Erland. Since you now know that I know everything about you, sit down." The priest sat down in the same position as before. Erland stretched out in front of him, lying with one hand propped under his chin and looking up at his brother's strangely tense and rigid face. Then he smiled.
"What is it, Gunnulf? Are you about to confess to me?"
"Yes," said his brother softly. But then he fell silent for a long time. Erland noticed that his lips moved once, and he clasped his hands tighter around his knee.
"What is it?"
He gave him a fleeting smile.
"It can't be that you... that some fair woman out there in the southern lands..."
"No," said the priest. His voice had a peculiar gruff tone. "This is not about love. Do you know, Erlan, how it happened that I was promised to the priesthood?"
"Yes. When our brothers died and they thought they were going to lose us too."
"No," said Gunnulf. "They thought Munan had regained his health, and Gauta was not ill at all. He didn't die until the next winter. But you lay in bed and were suffocating. And that's when Mother promised that I would serve Saint Olav if he would save your life."
"Who told you that?"
asked Erland after a moment. "Ingrid, my foster mother."
"Well, I would have been an odd gift to offer to Saint Olav," said Erland with a laugh. "He would have been poorly served by me. But you've told me, Gunnulf, that you were pleased even as a boy to be called to the priesthood."
"Yes," said the priest, "but it was not always so. I remember the day you left Husaby along with Munan Bardsson to journey to our kinsman, the king, to join his service. Your horse danced beneath you, and your new weapons gleamed and shone. I would never bear weapons. You were handsome, my brother. You were only 16 winters old, and I had already noticed long ago that women and maidens were fond of you."
"All that glory was short-lived," said Erland. "I learned to cut my nails straight across, to swear on the name of Jesus with every other word, and to resort to my dagger to defend myself when I wielded a sword. Then I was sent north and met her, and was banished with shame from the king's retinue, and our father closed his door to me."
"And you left the country with a beautiful woman," said Gunnulf in the same low voice. "We heard at home that you had become a chief of guards at Earl Jakob's castle."
"Well, it wasn't as grand as it seemed back home," said Erland, laughing.
"You and father were no longer friends. But he had so little regard for me that he didn't even bother to quarrel with me. Mother loved me, that I know. But she found me less worthy than you. I felt it the most when you left the country. You, brother, were the only one who had any real love for me. And God knows you were my dearest friend on earth.
but back when I was young and ignorant, I would sometimes think you had been given so much more than I had. Now I've told you, Erland. Erland lay with his face against the ground.
Don't go, Gunnulf, he begged.
I must, said the priest. Now we've told each other far too much. May God and the Virgin Mary grant that we meet again at a better time. Farewell, Erlon.
Farewell, said Erlon,
but did not look up. When Gunnulf, wearing traveling clothes, stepped out of the priest's house several hours later, he saw a man riding south across the fields toward the forest. He had a bow slung over his shoulder, and three dogs were running alongside his horse. It was Erlon. In the meantime, Kristin was walking briskly along the forest path over the ridge. The sun was now high, and the tops of the fir trees shone against the summer sky, but inside the woods it was still cool and fresh with the morning. A fragrant smell filled the air from spruce boughs, the marshy earth, and the twin flowers that covered the ground everywhere, in bloom with pairs of tiny pink bell-shaped blossoms. And the path, overgrown with grass, was damp and soft and felt good under her feet. Kristin walked along, saying her prayers. Now and then she would look up at the small white fair-weather clouds swimming in the blue above the treetops. The whole time she found herself thinking about Brother Edwin. This is how he had walked and walked, year in and year out, from early spring until late in the fall. Over mountain paths, through dark ravines and white snowdrifts. He rested in the mountain pastures, drank from the creeks, and ate from the bread that milkmaids and horse herdsmen brought out to him. Then he would bid them live well and God's peace and bestow blessings on both them and the livestock. Through rustling mountain meadows, the monk would hike down into the valley. Tall and stoop-shouldered, with his head bowed, he wandered the main roads past manors and farms, and everywhere he went, he would leave behind his loving prayers of intercession for everyone, like good weather. Kristin didn't meet a living soul, except for a few cows now and then. There were mountain pastures on the ridge. But it was a clearly marked path, with log bridges across the marshes. Kristin was not afraid. She felt as if the monk were walking invisibly at her side.
Brother Edwin, if it's true that you are a holy man, if you now stand before God, then pray for me.
Lord Jesus Christ, Holy Mary, Saint Olav. She longed to reach the destination of her journey. She longed to cast off the burden of years of concealed sins, the weight of church services and masses which she had stolen, unconfessed and unredeemed. She longed to be absolved and free, just as she had longed to be released from her burden this past spring, when she was carrying the child. He was sleeping soundly, safe on his mother's back. He didn't wake up until she had walked through the woods down to the farms of Snefell and could look out across Budvik and the arm of the fjord at Saltness. Kristin sat down in an outlying field, pulled the bundle with a child around into her lap, and loosened her robe at the breast. It felt good to hold him to her breast. It felt good to sit down, and a blessed warmth coursed through her whole body as she felt her stone-hard breasts bursting with milk, empty out as he nursed. The countryside below her lay silent and baking in the sun, with green pastures and bright fields amidst dark forest. A little smoke drifted up from the rooftops here and there. The hay harvesting had begun in a few places. She traveled by boat from Saltnessand over to Steina. Then she was in completely unfamiliar regions. The road through Binnis went past farms for a while. Then she reached the woods again, but there was no longer such a great distance between human dwellings. She was very tired. But then she thought about her parents. They had walked barefoot all the way from Jurengard at Sill, through Dovre, and on to Nidaros, carrying Ulvild on a litter between them. She must not think that Nokve was so heavy on her back. And yet her head itched terribly from the sweat under her thick homespun wimple. Around her waist, where the rope held her clothing close to her body, her shift had rubbed on her skin so that it felt quite raw.
After a while, there were others on the road. Now and then, people would ride past her. She caught up with a farmer's cart taking goods to town. The heavy wheels jolted and jounced over roots and stones, screeching and creaking. Two men were driving a beast to slaughter. They glanced at the young woman pilgrim because she was so beautiful. Otherwise, people were used to such wayfarers in these parts. At one place, several men were building a house a short distance from the road. They shouted to her, and an old man came running to offer her some ale. Kristen curtsied, took a drink, and thanked the man with such words as poor people usually said to her when she gave them alms. A little while later, she had to rest again. She found a small green hill along the road with a trickling creek. Kristen placed the child on the grass. He woke up and cried loudly, so she hurried distractedly through the prayers she had meant to say. Then she picked up Nokva, held him on her lap, and loosened the swaddling clothes. He had sullied his underclothes, and she had little to change him with, so she rinsed the cloths and spread them out to dry on a bare rock in the sun. She wrapped the outer garments loosely around the boy. He seemed to like this, and lay there kicking as he drank from his mother's breast. Kristen gazed happily at his fine, rosy limbs and pressed one of his hands between her breasts as she nursed him. Two men rode past at a fast trot. Kristen glanced up briefly. It was a nobleman and his servant. But suddenly the man reined in his horse, leaped from the saddle, and walked back to where she was sitting. It was Simon Andresen.
"Perhaps you won't be pleased that I stopped to greet you?" he asked.
He stood there holding his horse and looking down at her. He was wearing traveling clothes, with a sleeveless leather vest over a light blue linen tunic. He wore a small silk cap on his head, and his face was rather flushed and sweaty.
"It's strange to see you. But perhaps you'd rather not speak to me?"
"Surely you should know. How are you, Simon?"
Kristen tucked her bare feet under the hem of her skirts and tried to take the child from her breast. But the boy screamed, opening his mouth to suckle, so she had to let him nurse again. She pulled the robe over her breast as best she could and sat with her eyes lowered.
"Is it yours?" asked Simon, pointing to the child. "That was a foolish question," he laughed. "It's a son, isn't it?" "He's blessed with good fortune, Erland Nikolausen."
He tied his horse to a tree, and now he sat down on a rock not far from Kristen. He placed his sword between his knees and sat with his hands on the hilt, poking at the dirt with the point of the scabbard.
"It was unexpected to meet you here in the north, Simon," said Kristen, just for something to say.
"Yes," said Simon. "I haven't had business in this part of the country before."
Kristen recalled that she had heard something at the welcome celebration for her at Husaby about the youngest son of Arne Gjavaldsen of Ranheim being betrothed to Andres Dare's youngest daughter, so she asked him whether that's where he had been.
"You know about it?" asked Simon. "Well, I suppose it must have been talked about all through these parts."
"So it's true," said Kristen, "that Gjavald is to marry Sigrid?"
Simon looked up abruptly, pressing his lips together.
"I see you don't know everything after all."
"I haven't been beyond the courtyard of Husaby all winter," said Kristen, "and I've seen few people. I heard there was talk of this marriage."
"You might as well hear it from my lips, then. The news will doubtless reach here soon enough."
He sat in silence for a moment.
"Gjavald died 3 days before winter night. He fell off his horse and broke his back. Do you remember before you reached Difrin how the road heads east of the river and there's a steep drop-off? No, you probably don't. We were on our way to their betrothal celebration. Arne and his sons had come by ship to Oslo."
Then Simon fell silent. "She must have been happy, Sigrid, because she was going to marry Gjavald," said Kristen, shy and timid.
"Yes," said Simon. "And she had a son by him on the feast day of the apostles this spring."
"Oh, Simon."
"Sigrid Andresdotter, with the brown curls framing her small round face. Whenever she laughed, deep dimples appeared in her cheeks. The dimples and the small, childish white teeth. Simon had them too. Kristen remembered that when she grew less kindly inclined toward her betrothed, these things seemed to her unmanly, especially after she had met Erlan. They were much alike, Sigrid and Simon. But in her case, it seemed charming that she was so plump and quick to laughter. She was 14 winters old back then. Kristen had never heard such merry laughter as Sigrid's. Simon was always teasing his youngest sister and joking with her. Kristen could see that of all his siblings, he was most fond of her. "You know that father loved Sigrid best," said Simon. "That's why he wanted to see whether she and Gjavald would like each other before he made this agreement with Arne. And they did. In my mind, a little more than was proper. They always had to sit close whenever they met, and they would steal looks at each other and laugh. That was last summer at Dyfrin. But they were so young. No one could have imagined this. And our sister Astrid, you know she was betrothed when you and I... Well, she voiced no objections. Torgrim is very wealthy and kind, and in a certain way... But he finds fault with everyone and everything, and he thinks he suffers from all the ailments and troubles that anyone can name. So all of us were happy when Sigrid seemed so pleased with the man chosen for her. And then we brought Gjavald's body to the manor. Hallfrid, my wife, arranged things so that Sigrid would come home with us to Manvik. And then it came out that Sigrid wasn't left alone when Gjavald died. They were silent for a while. Then Kristen said softly, "This has not been a joyful journey for you, Simon." "No, it hasn't." Then he gave a laugh. "But I've gotten used to traveling on unfortunate business, Kristen. And I was the closest one, after all. Father lacked the courage, and they're living with me at Manvik, Sigrid and her son. But now he'll have a place in his father's lineage, and I could see from all of them there that he won't be unwelcome, the poor little boy, when he goes to live with them."
"But what of your sister?" asked Kristen breathlessly. "Where is she to live?"
Simon looked down at the ground. "Father will take her home to Dyfrin now," he said in a low voice.
"Simon! Oh, how can you have the heart to agree to this?"
"You must realize," he replied without looking up, "that it's a great advantage for the boy, that he'll be part of his father's family from the beginning. Hallfrid and I, we would have liked to keep both of them with us. No sister could be more loyal and loving toward another than Hallfrid is toward Sigrid. None of our kinsmen has been unkind toward her. You mustn't think that. Not even father. Although this has made him a broken man. But can't you see? It wouldn't be right if any of us objected to the innocent boy gaining inheritance and lineage from his father." Kristen's child let go of her breast. She quickly drew her garments closed over her bosom and, trembling, hugged the infant close. He hiccuped happily a couple of times and then spit up a little over himself and his mother's hands. Simon glanced at the two of them and said with an odd smile, "You had better luck, Kristen, than my sister did."
"Yes, no doubt it may seem unfair to you," said Kristen softly, "that I'm called wife and my son was lawfully born. I might have deserved to be left with the fatherless child of a paramour."
"That would seem to me the worst thing I could have heard," said Simon. "I wish you only the best, Kristen," he said even more quietly. A moment later, he asked her for directions. He mentioned that he had come north by ship from Tunsberg. "Now I must continue on and see about catching up with my servant."
"Is it Finn who's traveling with you?" asked Kristen.
"No. Finn is married now. He's no longer in my service." "Do you still remember him?" asked Simon, and his voice sounded pleased.
"Is Sigrid's son a handsome child?" asked Kristen, looking at Nokve.
"I hear that he is. I think one infant looks much like another," replied Simon.
"Then you must not have children of your own," said Kristen, giving a little smile.
No, he said curtly. Then he bid her farewell and rode off. When Kristen continued on, she didn't put her child on her back. She carried him in her arms, pressing his face against the hollow of her neck. She could think of nothing else but Sigrid Andrasdottir. Her own father would not have been able to do it. Should Lavrans Björgulfsson ride off to beg for a place and rank for his daughter's bastard child among the father's kinsmen? He would never have been able to do that. And never, never would he have had the heart to take her child away from her. To pull a tiny infant out of his mother's arms, tear him away from her breast while he still had mother's milk on his innocent lips. My Nokva. No, he wouldn't do that. Even if it were 10 times more just to do so, my father would not have done it. But she couldn't get the image out of her mind, a group of horsemen vanishing north of the gorge, where the valley grows narrow and the mountains crowd together, black with trees. Cold wind comes in gusts from the river, which thunders over the rocks, icy green and frothing, with deep black pools in between. Whoever throws himself into it would be crushed in the rapids at once. Jesus, Maria. Then she envisioned the fields back home at Urengard on a light summer night. She saw herself running down the path to the green clearing in the alder grove near the river, where they used to wash clothes. The water rushed past with a loud, monotonous roar along the flat riverbed filled with boulders. Lord Jesus, there is nothing else I can do. Oh, but Father would not have had the heart to do it. No matter how right it was. If I begged and begged him, begged on my knees, Father, you mustn't take my child from me. Kristen stood on the hill at Fegginsbrekka and looked down at the town lying at her feet in the golden evening sun. Beyond the wide, glittering curve of the river lay brown farm buildings with green sod roofs. The crowns of the trees were dark and dome-like in the gardens. She saw light-colored stone houses with stepped gables, churches thrusting their black, shingle-covered backs into the air, and churches with dully gleaming roofs of lead. But above the green landscape, above the glorious town, rose Christ Church so magnificently huge and radiantly bright, as if everything lay prone at its feet. With the evening sun on its breast and the sparkling glass of its windows, with its towers and dizzying spires and gilded weather vanes, the cathedral stood pointing up into the bright summer sky. All around lay summer green land, bearing venerable manors on its hills. In the distance the fjord opened out, shining and wide, with drifting shadows from the large summer clouds that billowed up over the glittering blue mountains on the other side. The cloister island looked like a green wreath with flowers of stone-white buildings, softly lapped by the sea. So many ships' masts out among the islands. So many beautiful houses. Overcome and sobbing, the young woman sank down before the cross at the side of the road, where thousands of pilgrims had lain and thanked God because helping hands were extended to them on their journey through the perilous and beautiful world. The bells of the churches and cloisters were ringing for vespers as Kristen entered the courtyard of Christ Church. For a moment she ventured to glance up at the west gable. Then she lowered her dazzled eyes. Human beings could not have done this work on their own. God's Spirit had been at work in Holy Erstein and the men who built the church after him. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Now she understood those words. A reflection of the splendor of God's kingdom bore witness through the stones that his will was all that was beautiful. Kristen trembled. Yes, God must surely turn away with scorn from all that was vile, from sin and shame and impurity. Along the galleries of the heavenly palace stood holy men and women, and they were so beautiful that she dared not look at them. The imperishable vines of eternity wound their way upward, calm and lovely, bursting into flower on spires and towers with stone monstrances. Above the center door hung Christ on the cross. Mary and John the Evangelist stood at his side. And they were white, as if molded from snow, and gold glittered on the white. 3 times Kristen walked around the church praying. The huge massive walls with their bewildering wealth of pillars and arches and windows, the glimpse of the roof's enormous slanting surface, the tower, the gold of the spire rising high into the heavens, Kristen sank to the ground beneath her sin. She was shaking as she kissed the hewn stone of the portal. In a flash, she saw the dark carved timber around the church door back home, where as a child she had pressed her lips after her father and mother. She sprinkled holy water over her son and herself, remembering that her father had done the same when she was small. With the child clasped tightly in her arms, she stepped forward into the church. She walked as if through a forest. The pillars were furrowed like ancient trees, and into the woods the light seeped, colorful and as clear as song, through the stained glass windows. High overhead, animals and people frolicked in the stone foliage, and angels played their instruments. At an even higher, more dizzying height, the vaults of the ceiling arched upward, lifting the church toward God. In a hall off to the side, a service was being held at an altar. Kristen fell to her knees next to a pillar. The song cut through her like a blinding light. Now she saw how deep in the dust she lay. Pater Noster, Credo in Unum Deum, Ave Maria, Gratia Plena. She had learned her prayers by repeating them after her father and mother before she could understand a single word, from as far back as she could remember. Lord Jesus Christ, was there ever a sinner like her? High beneath the triumphal arch, raised above the people, hung Christ on the cross. The pure virgin who was his mother stood looking up in deathly anguish at her innocent son who was suffering the death of a criminal. And here knelt Kristen with the fruit of her sin in her arms. She hugged the child tight. He was as fresh as an apple, pink and white like a rose. He was awake now, and he lay there looking up at her with his clear, sweet eyes. Conceived in sin, carried under her hard, evil heart, pulled out of her sin-tainted body, so pure, so healthy, so inexpressibly lovely and fresh and innocent. This undeserved beneficence broke her heart in two, crushed with remorse. She lay there with tears welling up out of her soul like blood from a mortal wound. Nokva, Nokva, my child. God visits the sins of the parents upon the children. Didn't I know that? Yes, I did. But I had no mercy for the innocent life that might be awakened in my womb, to be cursed and tormented because of my sin. Did I regret my sin while I was carrying you inside me, my beloved, beloved son? Oh no, there was no remorse. My heart was hard with anger and evil thoughts at the moment I first felt you move, so small and unprotected. Magnificat anima meo Dominum, et exultavit spiritus meus in Deo salutari meo. That is what she sang, the gentle queen of women, when she was chosen to bear the one who would die for our sins. I didn't think about the one who was the redeemer of my sin and my child's sin. Oh no, there was no remorse. Instead, I made myself pitiful and wretched and begged that the commandments of righteousness be broken, for I could not bear it if God should keep his promise and punish me in accordance with the word that I have known all my days. Oh yes, now she knew. She had thought that God was like her own father, that Holy Olav was like her father. All along she had expected, deep in her heart, that whenever the punishment became more than she could bear, then she would encounter not righteousness, but mercy. She wept so hard that she didn't have the strength to rise when the others stood up during the service. She stayed there, collapsed in a heap, holding her child. Near her, several other people knelt who did not rise either. 2 well-dressed farmers' wives with a young boy between them. She looked up toward the raised chancel. Beyond the gilded grated door, high up behind the altar, St. Olav's shrine glistened in the darkness. An ice-cold shiver ran down her back. There lay his holy body, waiting for Resurrection Day. Then the lid would spring open, and he would rise up. With his axe in hand, he would stride through this church. And from the stone floor, from the earth outside, from every cemetery in all of Norway, the dead yellow skeletons would rise up. They would be clothed in flesh and would rally around their king. Those who had striven to follow in his bloodied tracks, and those who had merely turned to him for help with the burdens of sin and sorrow and illness to which they had bound themselves and their children here in this life, they would crowd around their king and ask him to remind God of their need. Lord, hear my prayer for these people, whom I love so much that I would rather suffer exile and want and hatred and death than have a single man or maiden grow up in Norway not knowing that you died to save all sinners. Lord, you who bade us to go out and make everyone your disciple, with my blood I, Olav Haraldsson, wrote your gospel in the Norwegian language for these free men, my poor subjects. Kristen closed her eyes, feeling sick and dizzy. She saw the king's face before her. His blazing eyes pierced the depths of her soul. Now she trembled before St. Olaf's gaze. North of your village, Kristen, where I rested when my own countrymen drove me from my ancestral kingdom because they could not keep God's commandments. Wasn't a church built at that spot? Didn't knowledgeable men come there to teach you of God's word? Thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother. Thou shalt not kill. God visits the sins of the fathers upon the children. I died so that you might learn these teachings. Haven't they been given to you, Kristin Lavrans' daughter?
Oh, yes, yes, my lord and king.
Olav's church back home. She saw in her mind the pleasant brown-timbered room. The ceiling was not so high that it could frighten her. It was unassuming, built in God's honor from dark, tarred wood, in the same way that people constructed their mountain huts and storehouses and cattle sheds. But the timbers had been cut into supple staves, and they were raised and joined to form the walls of God's house. And Sarah Eirik taught each year on the church consecration day that in this manner we ought to use the tools of faith to cut and carve from our sinful natural being a faithful link in the Church of Christ. Have you forgotten this, Kristen? Where are the deeds that should bear witness for you on the last day, showing that you were a link in God's church? The good deeds which will bear witness that you belong to God.
Jesus, her good deeds.
She had repeated the prayers that were placed on her lips. She had given out the alms that her father had placed in her hands. She had helped her mother when Ronfred clothed the poor, fed the hungry, and tended to the sores of the ill. But the evil deeds were her own. She had clung to everyone who offered her protection and support. Brother Edvin's loving admonitions, his sorrow over her sin, his tender intercessionary prayers which she had received. And then she had flung herself into passionate sinful desire as soon as she was beyond the light of his gentle old eyes. She lay down in cowsheds and outbuildings and scarcely felt any shame that she was deceiving the good and honorable Abbess Groa. She had accepted the kind concern of the pious sisters and hadn't even had the wit to blush when they praised her gentle and seemly behavior before her father. Oh, the worst was thinking about her father. Her father, who had not said a single unkind word when he came to visit this spring. Simon had concealed the fact that he had caught his betrothed with a man at an inn for wandering soldiers. And she had let him take the blame for her breach of promise, had let him bear the blame before her father. Oh, but her father. That was the worst. No, her mother. That was even worse. If Nokva should grow up to show his mother as little love as she had shown her own mother. Oh, she couldn't bear it. Her mother, who had given birth to her and nursed her at her breast, kept watch over her when she was sick, washed and combed her hair and rejoiced at its beauty. And the first time that Kristen felt she needed her mother's help and comfort, she had waited for her mother to come, in spite of all her own disdain.
You should know that your mother would have come north to be with you if she had known that it might give you comfort, her father had said.
Oh, mother, mother, mother.
She had seen the water from the well back home. It looked so clean and pure when it was in the wooden cups. But her father owned a glass goblet, and when he filled it with water and the sun shone through, the water was muddy and full of impurities.
Yes, my lord and king, now I see the way I am.
Goodness and love she had accepted from everyone, as if they were her right. There was no end to the goodness and love she had encountered all her days. But the first time someone confronted her, she had risen up like a snake and struck. Her will had been as hard and sharp as a knife when she drove Elena Orm's daughter to her death. Just as she would have risen up against God himself if he had placed his righteous hand on the back of her neck.
Oh, how could her father and mother bear it?
They had lost three young children. They had watched Ulvild sicken until she died, after they had striven those long sorrowful years to give the child back her health. But they had borne all these trials with patience, never doubting that God knew what was best for their children. Then she had caused them all this sorrow and shame. But if there had been anything wrong with her child, if they had taken her child the way they were now taking Sigrid Andrasdottir's child from her,
oh, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
She had wandered to the very edge of Hell's abyss. If she should lose her son, after she had thrown herself into the seething rapids, turned away with scorn from any hope of joining the good and dear people who loved her, giving herself into the devil's power. It was no wonder that Nokve bore the mark of a bloody hand on his chest.
Oh, holy Olaf, you who heard me when I prayed for you to help my child, I prayed that you would turn the punishment upon me and spare the innocent one. Yes, Lord, I know how I kept my part of the agreement.
Like a wild heathen animal she had reared up at the first chastisement. Erlan. Not for a moment did she ever believe that he no longer loved her. If she had believed that, then she would not have had the strength to live. Oh no. But she had secretly thought that when she was beautiful again, and healthy and lively, then she would act in such a way that he would have to beg her. It wasn't that he had been unloving during the winter. But she, who had heard ever since she was a girl that the devil always keeps close to a woman with child and tempts her because she is weak, she had turned a willing ear to the devil's lies. She had pretended to believe that Erlan didn't care for her because she was ugly and ill, when she noticed that he was distressed because he had made both her and himself the subject of gossip. She had flung his timid and tender words back at him. And when she drove him to say harsh and thoughtless things, she would bring them up later to rebuke him. Jesus, what an evil woman she was. She had been a bad wife.
Now do you understand, Kristen, that you need help?
Yes, my lord and king, now I understand. I am in great need of your support, so that I won't turn away from God again. Stay with me, you who are the chieftain of his people. As I step forward with my prayers, pray for mercy for me. Holy Olaf, pray for me. Cor mundum crea in me Deus, et spiritum rectum in nova in vis cheribus meis. Ne progisias me a facia tua. Libera me de sanguinibus Deus. Deus salutis me.
The service was over. People were leaving the church. The two farmers' wives who were kneeling near Kristen stood up. But the boy between them did not get up. He began moving across the floor by setting his knuckles on the flagstones and hopping along like a fledgling crow. He had tiny legs, bent crooked under his belly. The women walked in such a way as to hide him with their clothes as best they could. When they were out of sight, Kristen threw herself down and kissed the floor where they had walked past her. Feeling lost and uncertain, she was standing at the entrance to the chancel
When a young priest came out the grated door, he stopped in front of the young woman with a tear-stained face, and Kristen did her best to explain the reason for her journey. At first, he didn't understand. Then she pulled out the golden crown and held it out.
Oh, are you Kristen Lavran's daughter, the wife of Erland of Huseby?
He gave her a rather surprised look. Her face was quite swollen from weeping.
Yes, your brother-in-law Gunnulf spoke of you, yes he did.
He led her into the sacristy and took the crown. He unwrapped the linen cloth and looked at it. Then he smiled.
Well, you must realize that there will have to be witnesses and the like. You can't give away such a costly treasure as if it were a piece of buttered lefse. But I can keep it for you in the meantime. No doubt you would prefer not to carry it around with you in town.
Oh, ask Herr Arne if he wouldn't mind coming here, he said to a sexton. I think that by rights your husband should be present too, but perhaps Gunnulf has a letter from him. You wish to speak to the archbishop himself, is that right? Otherwise there is Hauk Thomason, who is the penitentiarius. I don't know whether Gunnulf has spoken to Archbishop Eilif, but you must come here for matins tomorrow, and then you can ask for me after Lods. My name is Paul Oslaksen.
That,
and he pointed to the child, you must leave at the hostel.
I seem to remember your brother-in-law saying that you're staying with the sisters at Baka, is that right?
Another priest came in, and the two men talked to each other briefly. The first priest then opened a small cupboard in the wall and took out a balance scale and weighed the crown, while the other made a note of it in a ledger. Then they placed the crown in the cupboard and closed the door. Herr Paul was about to escort Kristen out, but then he asked her whether she would like him to lift her son up to St. Olav's shrine. He picked up the boy with the confident, almost indifferent ease of a priest who was used to holding children for baptism. Kristen followed him into the church, and he asked her whether she too would like to kiss the shrine.
I don't dare, thought Kristen,
but she accompanied the priest up the stairs to the dais on which the shrine stood. A great chalk-white light seemed to pass before her eyes as she pressed her lips to the golden chest. The priest looked at her for a moment, to see whether she might collapse in a faint, but she got to her feet. Then he touched the child's forehead to the sacred shrine. Herr Paul escorted Kristen to the church door and asked whether she was certain she could find her way to the ferry landing. Then he bade her good night. He spoke the whole time in an even and dry voice, like any other courteous young man in the king's service. It had started to rain lightly, and a wonderful fragrance wafted blessedly from the gardens and along the street, which, on either side of the worn ruts from the wheel tracks, was as fresh and green as a country courtyard. Kristen sheltered the child from the rain as best she could. He was heavy now, so heavy that her arms were quite numb from carrying him. And he fussed and cried incessantly. He was probably hungry again. The mother was dead tired from the long journey and from all the weeping and the intense emotions in the church. She was cold, and the rain was coming down harder. The drops splashed on the trees, making the leaves flutter and shake. She made her way down the lanes and came out onto a broad street. From there she could see the rushing river, wide and gray, its surface punctured like a sieve by the falling drops. There was no ferry boat. Kristen talked to two men who were huddled in a space beneath a warehouse, standing on posts at the water's edge. They told her to go out to the sandbanks. There the nuns had a house, and that's where the ferryman was. Kristen went back up the wide street, wet and tired and with aching feet. She came to a small gray stone church. Behind it stood several buildings enclosed by a fence. Nokve was screaming furiously, so she couldn't go inside the church. But she heard the song from the recessed paneless windows, and she recognized the antiphon. Laetare Regina Coeli, rejoice thou Queen of Heaven, for he whom you were chosen to bear has risen as he promised. Hallelujah.
This was what the minor rites sang after the completorium. Brother Edvin had taught her this hymn to the Lord's mother as Kristen kept vigil over him during those long nights when he lay deathly ill in their home at Urendgard. She crept out to the churchyard and, standing against the wall with her child in her arms, she repeated his words softly to herself. Nothing you do could ever change your father's heart toward you. This is why you must not cause him any more sorrow. As your pierced hands were stretched out on the cross, O precious Lord of heaven, no matter how far a soul might stray from the path of righteousness, the pierced hands were stretched out, yearning. Only one thing was needed, that the sinful soul should turn toward the open embrace, freely, like a child who goes to his father, and not like a thrall who is chased home to his stern master. Now Kristen realized how hideous sin was. Again she felt the pain in her breast, as if her heart were breaking with remorse and shame at the undeserved mercy. Next to the church wall, there was a little shelter from the rain. She sat down on a gravestone and set about quelling the child's hunger. Now and then she would bend down and kiss his little down-covered head. She must have fallen asleep. Someone was touching her shoulder. A monk and an old lay brother holding a spade in his hand stood before her. The barefoot brother asked if she was looking for shelter for the night. The thought raced through her mind that she would much rather stay here tonight with the Minorites, Brother Edvin's brothers. And it was so far to Baca, and she was nearly collapsing with weariness. Then the monk offered to have the lay servant accompany her to the women's hostel, and give her a little calamus poultice for her feet. I see that they are sore. It was stuffy and dark at the women's hostel, which stood outside the fence in the lane. The lay brother brought Kristen water to wash with and a little food, and she sat down near the hearth, trying to soothe her child. Nokva could no doubt tell from her milk that his mother was worn out and had fasted all day. He fretted and whimpered in between attempts to suckle from her empty breasts. Kristen gulped down the milk that the lay brother brought her. She tried to squirt it from her mouth into the child's, but the boy protested loudly at this new means of being fed, and the old man laughed and shook his head. She would have to drink it herself, and then it would benefit the boy. Finally, the man left. Kristen crept into one of the beds high up beneath the center roof beam. From there, she could reach a hatch. There was a foul smell in the hostel. One of the women was in bed with a stomach ailment. Kristen opened the hatch. The summer night was bright and mild. The rain-washed air streamed down on her. She sat in the short bed with her head leaning back against the timbers of the wall. There were few pillows for the beds. The boy was asleep in her lap. She had meant to close the hatch after a moment, but she fell asleep. In the middle of the night, she woke up. The moon, a pale, summery, honey gold, was shining down on her and the child and illuminating the opposite wall. At that moment, Kristen became aware of a person standing in the midst of the stream of moonlight, hovering between the gable and the floor. He was wearing an ash-gray monk's cowl. He was tall and stooped. Then he turned his ancient, furrowed face toward her. It was Brother Edvin. His smile was so inexpressibly tender, and a little sly and merry, just as it was when he lived on this earth. Kristen was not the least bit surprised. Humbly, joyfully, and filled with anticipation, she looked at him and waited for what he would say or do. The monk laughed and held up a heavy old leather glove toward her. Then he hung it on the moonbeam. He smiled even more, nodded to her, and then vanished. Part 2. Husaby. Chapter 1. One day, just after New Year's, unexpected guests arrived at Husaby. They were Lavrans Björgolfsson, an old Smead Gudliksson from Dovre. And they were accompanied by two gentlemen whom Kristen didn't know.
but Erland was very surprised to see his father-in-law in their company. They were Erling Vidkunsson from